From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The United States is about to enter COVID hell. That's how one advisor to President-elect Joe Biden put it this week on CNBC. The number of Americans with new infections is hitting records daily. Yesterday, Johns Hopkins University recorded more than 144,000 new cases. And we haven't heard from President Trump or Vice President Pence on the pandemic in days. Dr. Emily Landon is the Executive Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Medicine. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And let's start by focusing in where you are now, the state of Illinois. Officials there reported 145 deaths yesterday. It's the highest single-day death toll that the state has seen since May. What concerns you about the state of things in Illinois?
Well, the hospitals are getting more and more full. We're seeing some hospitals having to switch to their surge planning. I know that at my hospital, staffing is becoming a challenge. We're certainly competing with Wisconsin for sort of extra staffing, which we used back in March. But there's even more people in Illinois that have not gotten sick yet. And if everyone gets sick at the same time, there's just not enough healthcare professionals, beds, space, and supplies to care for everyone.
Which would explain the surge planning in the hospitals. What does that look like? Well, what is surge planning?
Well, surge planning is trying to take what you have and do more. So we're trying to find more space, trying to use beds that are allocated to other areas and try and shift them over, trying to cut back on caring for patients that don't necessarily need urgent care. That often means that some elective procedures may get rescheduled. At most hospitals are trying to get as many elective procedures done now as possible. But we also know that once we have to stop doing some of those things in order to save space for people with emergency problems, it could be a long time before people can get back in to do those things.
Is what you're seeing now and what you might see in the weeks and months ahead, do you think that could be worse than what you experienced in the spring?
You know, a few weeks ago, I had said that I knew we were going to see a surge, but that I didn't think it was going to be quite as bad as what we saw in the spring. And I have to say that I need to change my thinking about that. I think this could be at least as bad as what we saw in Chicago. And I'm concerned about the duration of time that we're going to have to sustain it.
Well, your governor, J.B. Pritzker, is watching this closely. He upgraded restrictions for 11 regions in the state of Illinois that will limit indoor and outdoor gatherings to 10 people. It will also prohibit indoor service at bars and restaurants. So, I mean, some changes in response here, but is it enough?
You know, this is a really difficult situation to think about. I think those restrictions are welcomed by the medical professionals and by people who are really concerned about this. And I think we probably are going to need to do more. The
like
numbers
a full
are
lockdown.
Just, well, I'm not sure that a full lockdown, I'm saying that with air quotes, is really the right thing. We know a lot more now than we did in March. There are things that we can do to be a lot more tailored about sort of a stay at home kind of order. The most important thing, though, is that people are having these little gatherings inside their homes. They're doing what they were doing outside in the summertime, you know, having a barbecue and maybe not wearing masks while they ate, but keeping apart, and it's outside, so there's a lot of ventilation. And they're moving that indoors and thinking that's going to be sufficient, and it's just not. Our indoor ventilation systems are not capable of protecting people from COVID with just 6 feet of distance unless the unmasked time period is really short, like just like a few minutes. And so having people in your house and saying, I'm going to just keep us 6 feet apart is not going to work. And that's a big reason why we're seeing the spread.
Well, Dr. Landon, as these numbers spiral out of control across the country, a lot of people are wondering, where is the federal government? There are no public briefings. The Vice President, Mike Pence, head of the Coronavirus Task Force, has been more or less silent. President Trump hasn't spoken publicly in days. I mean, do you think the leadership vacuum at the federal level is getting worse and affecting the severity of this pandemic?
Absolutely. The silence is deafening. People are suffering. Healthcare is at the edge of failing. In North Dakota, they're letting people with COVID work caring for patients because they don't have enough people to care for patients. This is unbelievable. I never imagined that our government would turn a blind eye to so much suffering. And it's just, you know, it has a dual effect. It makes healthcare workers and patients with COVID and people with COVID and people trying to get healthcare for other issues feel abandoned. And, you know, other people who maybe feel less vulnerable to COVID, it just encourages them to continue to think that there's not a problem. But this is a huge catastrophe. You know, the number of people dying in the United States every day is like having three or four completely full planes crash to the ground and everyone die. Can you imagine if every night's news had three plane crashes and it just kept happening every single day, and then it was four, and then it was five? No one would stand for that. And I cannot imagine how anyone can turn a blind eye to this.
Dr. Emily Landon, Executive Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Medicine. I know it's not possible probably for you to be busier, so thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
It's really important to get the message out. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've begun looking at things President Trump did that President-elect Biden has promised to undo, and one is the Iran nuclear deal, which President Trump pulled the U.S. out of in 2018. The agreement, signed during the Obama administration, put restrictions on Tehran's nuclear ambitions in exchange for sanctions relief. President Trump reimposed those sanctions when he abandoned the deal 2 years ago, and they've been crippling Iran's economy. And yesterday, a report from the International Atomic Energy Agency said Iran is violating the agreement in increasing its stockpile of low-enriched uranium and also enriching it to a higher level of purity than permitted. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's with MIT Security Studies Program. So, Jim, does Iran have the material to produce a nuclear weapon?
No. I mean, you need highly enriched uranium or plutonium. Iran has neither. It has some low-enriched uranium, which it could, over a period of time, if it kicked out all the inspectors and tore off all the inspections equipment and sensors, might be able to convert to highly enriched uranium at some point. But no, I mean, what Iran did during the Iran deal, which was on life support and looks like it's actually going to survive, what it did to push back at a certain point was sort of stuff at the margins. You know, we'll increase the amount of low-enriched uranium we have. We'll do this, we'll do that. But on the fundamentals, they didn't do anything. And everything they did, they announced at the time they did it, was reversible.
Exactly. So now if I'm reading this report right, they said when they increased things, they were transparent, and they're still getting some inspections, right?
Yes, and IAEA is doing its job, and I think it's doing a pretty darn good job, the international inspectors, and they have a careful eye. But I think here's the – when we step back from what's going on. So Iran sort of tried to punch back a little by with minor violations of the JCPOA, this Iran deal, but they didn't do any of the big things. And their president announced that they are willing to go back to full compliance if Biden and the U.S. rejoin the deal. So that's the question. We're all on hold, again, all of us on another topic, and that's going to be the future of this agreement. Now, Biden says he wants to join it, but there is a debate in the Biden camp. And the debate goes something like this. Well, yes, we should join quickly rather than letting it drag, because bad things will happen if we wait. And then others say, well, we should wait and try to get a better deal. Or we should use all this leverage that Trump built up by hitting Iran with a stick. We should use that ourselves and try to get a better deal. And that's the debate. Do they try to push the Iranians again, or do they go back to the status quo before that opportunity is lost? I tend to think a quick process is better than a slow one. But that's the debate right now on the Biden people.
But, and on the other hand, we still don't know what the balance in the Senate is going to be. And, you know, going a little bit to the side of those who want a tougher deal, who think it's flawed, as President Trump did, might help get that deal through. But in the couple minutes we have, I just have to ask you about what we're watching, Jim, as someone like you who watches national security. How concerned are you about President Trump impeding this transition to the Biden presidency, also firing the Secretary of Defense, appointing loyalists to Pentagon positions? It's caused fear that he may send the military into the streets of the U.S. to suppress protesters because, you know, Defense Secretary Esper would not allow him to do that. Some of these loyalists would be more for that. So that's caused a lot of fear. Or that he may start a war with Iran.
You know, weirdly, I have to say, all those things are on the table. I don't worry so much about the Biden transition. I think that is going to happen. Call me an optimist. I think the president-elect will take office. And they're all pros. They've been in there before. This is not their first rodeo. They'll be able to figure it out. I do worry about the president, but maybe a little different than everyone else. We all have our concerns. I'm sort of worried that he's mailing it in, right? We haven't heard from him. He's playing golf. Maybe he's just angry and isn't going to go back to work. And he's fired the Secretary of Defense. You know, what is that, the fourth one in 4 years? I can't even keep count anymore. And so the whole system seems to be, you know, spinning here on the verge of coming undone. And then I would say, I won't assume you'll do that, something malicious will happen, but let's say there's another crisis in the world. And then for all of you say, well, that can't happen. I have one word for you, COVID. You know, anything could happen over 3 months. And if the president isn't firmly focused on it with a national security team that is ready to meet the challenge, that concerns me.
Jim Walsh, here now, security analyst, also with MIT Security Studies Program. And as he said, maybe a cockeyed optimist, but I don't know. Sounded kind of dark there, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
President-elect Joe Biden has vowed to make climate change a priority and get the U.S. back in the Paris Climate Accord on day one of his administration. President Trump, in the waning days of his presidency, has installed officials skeptical of climate change in top science positions. Meanwhile, it's been a year of catastrophic wildfires and hurricanes. According to NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, the first 9 months of 2020 brought a record-tying $16 billion worth of weather disasters to the U.S. Well, we thought perfect time to convene another Climate Change Reporter Roundtable, people on this beat from across the country. Today, Tegan Wendland, an energy and environment reporter for WWNO in New Orleans. Tegan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sam Brash is a climate reporter for Colorado Public Radio in Denver. Hi, Sam.
Glad to be here.
And rounding out our group today, Umair Irfan, who covers climate change, energy, and the environment for Vox. He's in Washington, D.C. Umair, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Tegan, I'm going to start with you. Louisiana still recovering after back-to-back major hurricanes. You say thousands of people remain displaced. Has that at all affected how people view climate change? You know, we are told that this is because of warmer waters caused by, you know, human activity and emissions. Are you seeing more people kind of embracing that and more concerned about climate change?
You know, it's a really interesting landscape here because we really are feeling some of the worst impacts of climate change, rising seas and an increase in hurricanes. We had 5 named storms hit the state this year. 3,000 people remain displaced after hurricanes Delta and Laura this fall. And yet the state continues to rely heavily on oil and gas and largely votes for Republican lawmakers who don't embrace climate change agendas. So, you know, unsurprisingly, the state voted again for President Trump by a landslide and reelected Senator Bill Cassidy, who's criticized Biden's comments on transitioning to clean energy in TV ads. Yet our Democratic governor, John Bel Edwards, just formed this climate task force made up of scientists and advocates to work towards carbon neutrality by 2050. And the state has one of the most aggressive climate mitigation plans in the nation and its coastal master plan to restore the coast. So Louisiana is just really a land of contradictions.
Right. Well, probably a sharper view of the whole country, you know, a land of contradictions. And what is something that you want to focus more on going into 2021?
I think, you know, really digging into the irony of the fact that most of our coastal restoration efforts are funded by the oil and gas industry, both through the BP oil spill settlement fund and a portion of the sale of offshore leases. That's the way it's set up right now. So we, you know, can have some very ambitious climate mitigation plans in place, but they're reliant on the continued success of the oil and gas industry.
Right. And people there are just reliant on the job. So is there some sensitivity to that, some sense of how do we help people transition, you know, people transition away from an industry that's their living.
For sure. There's a lot of talk of transitioning to green energy jobs and to jobs in coastal restoration, but that has largely been talk. There's not a lot of concerted effort to retrain people in those specific areas. And we're seeing sort of this unmitigated retreat away from the coast. With every damaging storm, we see people move north to higher ground, and the folks who are left behind are lower income people who can't necessarily afford to make those moves on their own. So, you know, there's really a need for federal funding to help with a managed retreat away from these low-lying, dangerous areas.
Yeah. Sam Brash there in Denver, Colorado. Much of your recent reporting has been on the late season wildfires there. Usually the season's finished by October, but this year you saw some of the worst at a time when you say people were getting ready to ski. So what have you been focusing on in terms of your climate reporting there in Colorado?
I mean, a lot of what we've had to worry about is just picking up the pieces here from what we saw last month. I mean, it was truly catastrophic. This year, we saw a couple fires break the record for the first and second largest wildfires in Colorado history. And all of that really does track back to climate change. I mean, climate change is causing droughts, and that all adds up to a longer, hotter wildfire season, and that's what we're seeing. So one thing we're thinking a lot about is, like, what kind of mitigation work does need to happen here on the ground in Colorado? What does it look like, and how does it look different from place to place?
That sounds like what you'll be looking at going into 2021. Anything else?
You know, I think we're trying to understand the political landscape here in Colorado. I mean, Tegan talked about what's going on in Louisiana. I mean, I think the political shift here in Colorado is truly remarkable. We don't have a Republican left in statewide political office. Both chambers of our legislature are controlled by Democrats. Biden won big here in Colorado, and I think it's clear that, you know, climate was one of the things that was driving people to the polls. It's kind of curious how it shook out a little bit. The new senator from Colorado is John Hickenlooper, who doesn't have the best reputation among environmental advocates here because of some of the things he did around fracking as governor. But it's a big shift towards Democrats, and it seems like climate is a winning issue from that.
Interesting. Well, speaking of politics, let's bring in Umer Irfan, who's with Vox. And you're looking at this on a national scale. You're going to be busy following how these local impacts are addressed by the Biden administration. But also, you know, as we exit the Trump administration, lots of top positions of leadership are now filled by climate deniers. So just what are you looking at?
Right. One of the things that we're trying to pay attention to is personnel, because personnel is policy. And as you noted, yes, on the way out the door, the Trump administration is trying to move a lot of their political appointments into career positions so that they'll remain behind after they leave office. And one of the critical things that they're trying to aim at is this report called the National Climate Assessment. And this is a report that's mandated by Congress, and the federal government has to put it together to assess all the risks of climate change that are affecting the country. And then the government has to plan around this. And so the idea is, if you can get a lot of people that are more aligned with the Trump administration's view on climate change, basically that it's not a big issue, they'll have a weaker report come out that will require the government to do less. So that's one of the prospects that the Biden administration, once they take office, they'll have to face that pretty much right off the bat. The other big thing is that, you know, Mitch McConnell and the congressional Republicans have already said that they're trying to stifle Biden from filling his administration with the people he wants. And so trying to get his team on board is going to be the very first challenge he's going to face.
Yeah. So definitely personnel. What else are you watching? Just tell us briefly.
Yes. And so without Congress, I mean, Joe Biden has put out a list of executive actions that he wants to take, things like limiting methane emissions from public lands and also using the federal government's procurement system. You know, the federal government is massive and they buy a lot of stuff. And so if they can ensure the federal government buys clean energy, clean vehicles and so forth, they think they can move the market. And so he wants to be able to do everything that's within his purview to shift towards cleaner energy. And one thing that he is also aiming to do is also collaborate with state and local governments, like you know, governments in Louisiana and in Colorado, because while Congress may not be on board, a lot of state and local officials do realize that climate change is a problem, and they've built a coalition over the last 4 years to try to address it.
Well, this is, of course, why there's so many eyes on the runoff in Georgia with two Senate seats up for grabs there. I just want to, in the just a little time that we have, I want to ask each of you if you have a question for another. Tegan, I hate to put you on that spot first, but go.
So, Sam, winter snow is finally snuffing out the record-breaking wildfires there in your state. And I imagine people are now taking stock of the damage. So who's going to be able to rebuild, and are there policies to ensure that they do so safely?
That's a really good question. I think it's something that we're trying to figure out right now. There were a few hundred structures that it looks like were destroyed in this latest group of October fires. Whether all those buildings are insured, whether they're first homes, second homes, who's able to rebuild, who's not, whether, you know, continued or planned developments are going to go forward in this wildland urban interface, that's something we really need to look into and dig into and figure out. You know, one of the things that you have to do if fires are just part of the landscape is build around it, prepare for it. And you have to build homes in a different way. It might mean you don't get to build homes, period. And so the short answer is I don't know, but it's something we're trying to find out more about.
This is certainly something we're grappling with here, too, in terms of who can live where and how we make sure that people aren't living in unsafe and vulnerable places. And I guess I just think of relocation as the ultimate human adaptation.
Umair, you've got a question now.
Yeah, for Tegan, I mean, you did talk about, you know, the climate change refugees. And I recall during the presidential campaign last year, you know, the Democrats, they had this big climate change town hall, and they had people from Ile de Jean Charles talking about, you know, having to relocate. And I'm wondering, is there sort of a political groundswell in Louisiana among these people that are being facing the consequences of climate change? And how is that affecting the political picture in the state?
There's certainly some organizing within these communities advocating for themselves. But I think we're also seeing at the federal level, even though NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, hasn't necessarily embraced policies that will fund relocation, HUD and FEMA are creating huge multi-billion dollar programs to pay for these things because it's inevitable that this is going to continue to happen across the country. So we got nearly $50 million to relocate the people of this tiny little disappearing island of Ile de Jean Charles, and that the process is taking a very long time. It's very challenging, a lot more complicated than we maybe anticipated. But, you know, perhaps we'll create a model for communities across the country in years to come.
Yeah, and COVID didn't help. That's Tegan Wendland, energy and environment reporter for WWNO in New Orleans. We also heard from Sam Brash, climate reporter for Colorado Public Radio in Denver, and Umair Irfan, a climate, energy, and environment reporter for Vox in Washington, D.C. You guys, I mean, when we first did this, we had to scrounge around to try to find climate reporters. And now, you know, you're a growing group, and we so appreciate your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Today is the deadline for TikTok to find a buyer for its U.S. operations. Otherwise, the popular social media platform will have to shut down. You'll remember that President Trump issued that deadline after threatening to ban the app in the U.S. But the day has arrived, and TikTok says it still hasn't heard from the Trump administration on its proposal. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, you know, the thing is, TikTok actually has a deal with Oracle and Walmart that it's trying to get through, right?
Yeah, and in fact, on Tuesday, TikTok petitioned a federal appeals court to halt the enforcement of the executive order that Trump signed on August 14th, because it's saying it wants a 30-day extension to finalize the deal with Oracle and Walmart. It hasn't received the extension from the government. In fact, it says the federal government hasn't offered any feedback on the company's efforts to either make this deal or strengthen data security. The Chinese government, because it's owned by ByteDance, a Chinese company, has also not signed off on this deal. There are some judges in D.C. and Pennsylvania that have already blocked Donald Trump's outright ban on TikTok. But he has another executive order that would remove them from the App Store and prohibit U.S. companies from hosting its data beginning today. So that's what the issue is.
So what do you think is going on? Has the president kind of just forgotten about TikTok because it's focused on other things, or is this on purpose?
Yeah, I think the entire Trump infrastructure right now is focused on something else, on the election and the outcome of it. So it seems to have slipped Trump's mind. We haven't had a public appearance other than for Veterans Day, but we haven't heard from the president since Tuesday, and we haven't got any planned appearances. He also hasn't met with the COVID task force. So there are things that are more important than TikTok that are not happening right now. So I think TikTok may get its, you know, may get what it needs just because there's no remedy that's been prescribed by the government. If TikTok doesn't do anything by today, we're not sure what's actually supposed to happen.
You are right. I mean, there's a lot of other things going on, and people might be wondering, well, I don't use TikTok. I don't care about it. On the other hand, it's kind of symbolic of the president's battle with China over the years. And, you know, it's going to play a role in the next administration. Do you think that Joe Biden has any interest in this topic whatsoever?
Well, so cut the topic into two. It's part of Trump's battle with China, and it's part of Trump's battle with social media. And Biden's technology advisor says it's too early for Biden to articulate a view on TikTok. But in July, the Biden campaign told its employees, by the way, to delete TikTok from their work and personal devices because of security concerns. So clearly there's something out there that they're worried about as it relates to the security issues from China. During a campaign stop in September, Biden did express some apprehension about TikTok, but we don't know what their policies are going to be on the company and whether they'll follow through on what Donald Trump has threatened.
We've got less than a minute to go, but weigh in on today's weekly unemployment claims, another 709,000 people looking for work.
Yeah, so it's fewer people seeking unemployment insurance, but the weekly jobless claims still remain at about three times the level they were before the coronavirus pandemic. Job growth is slowing. We now have this problem with the resurgence of coronavirus across America, and as a result, we're going to see restaurant closures again, gym closures, things like that. So the relief that we've seen for the last couple of months might start to turn the other direction. The bottom line is we won't solve the employment situation until we solve the coronavirus, and it's getting worse, not better.
It sure is. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi, thank you as always.
Thanks, Peter.
As Republicans process the results of the 2020 election, losing the presidency but picking up multiple seats in the House, many are wondering what the future of the party will look like. Stuart Stevens is one of those people. He's a longtime political operative and author of the book, It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. Stevens is also a contributor to the Lincoln Project, a Republican super PAC that spent a fortune opposing President Trump in 2020. Stevens endorsed Joe Biden earlier this year, but before all that, he was a central player in the campaigns of George W. Bush and Mitt Romney. Stuart Stevens, welcome.
Thanks very much. Great to be here, man.
You know, just as recently as 2019, when you were writing your book, you said that you believed Donald Trump would still win this election. You know, what's your analysis on why he didn't?
A lot of prayer. Now, look, I think that I wrote that pre-COVID. So these large external forces came into play, and I think that had a large factor in his defeat.
Well, the Democrats are going to take credit, rightfully so. I mean, obviously, a big coalition of Democrats came together to lift up Biden and to beat Trump. But what about the Lincoln Project and other unhappy Republicans like yourself? I mean, do you have any evidence that your efforts played a role in this election?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of evidence. You know, we concentrated on 80-plus counties, and I think Biden was able to win all the counties that we focused on. And look, I think the Biden campaign ran a historically great campaign. I mean, they were able to flip Arizona, Wisconsin, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and get more votes than any other candidate in the history of a country. That's not a bad night.
Well, and here we are, almost a week since the race was called for Joe Biden. The president isn't giving it up. He's not conceding, and he's claiming without evidence that there's voter fraud, that the election was stolen from him. You've been around for a long time in Republican circles. Have you ever seen significant voter fraud in the U.S. election?
No. What's happening now is a total disgrace. I mean, I wrote a pretty bleak book about the Republican Party. It was all a lie. But I never would have imagined that four Republican senators have said that Donald Trump lost the race. Joe Biden's a president-elect. Only four. This is basically a talking point of America's enemies, that we don't really have a democracy. You can't tell who won. I mean, the Russians have been saying this since the 1920s. Iran says it. North Korea says it. It's unpatriotic. It's, I think, a failure of their oath of office, which is to support democracy. And it's really despicable. I mean, all these Republicans thought they could go along with Trump and get what they wanted, be it, you know, a judge, be it reducing marginal tax rates for corporations, and that none of the negatives of Trump would really hold over after he left office. I mean, that was always naive and self-serving and wrong. And they made this deal with the devil. And what people, you know, should remember about deals with Mephistopheles is not only does he not, he takes your soul, he also doesn't deliver.
But 72 million people would disagree with that. I mean, that's how many people voted for Donald Trump. And, you know, it seems to me that the Republican Party actually is pretty alive and well, even if you don't like where it is.
Well, look, you know, the big picture here, I think, really is to focus on Texas. Because once Texas goes Democratic, Republicans can't win. That's it. It's over. Lights out. And they're going to win. Democrats are going to win Texas. They'll probably win Texas in 2024. And I would predict by 2030, the big Republican push is going to be to abolish the Electoral College because they're not going to be able to win. So there are larger trends here that I think are very negative for the Republican Party and very positive for the Democratic Party.
I want to look back for just a moment because I know you despise where the party has ended up and you don't seem optimistic about the future for the party. But look, you were an insider for decades. You ran, I can just tell by talking to you, you were no weak-kneed political strategist. You ran some pretty bare-knuckled campaigns. Your client, Mitt Romney, as you probably know, a frequent guest and fill-in host for the radio talk show host Jay Severin, who was fired for saying, kill all the Muslims. You know, it's not like Trumpism just came out of nowhere. And, you know, you were there while this movement was building.
Look, I mean, this, you know, what led me to write this book. I worked for George Bush. I went down to work for him in 99 in Austin. We believed that compassionate conservatism was the future of the party. And I think a lot of us, certainly I did, thought that the side of the party we were on was inevitable, that we were the dominant gene and that what I would call dark side was recessive gene. I think I was wrong. So I do think that I have responsibility here. I do think I should have done more. I do think I should have seen this and been more realistic about it. But I say in this book, I think one of the reasons I didn't see it is because it was inconvenient for me to see it.
Yeah. In 2012, the party was reflective about where it went wrong when Mitt Romney lost. You know, it planned to diversify its outreach to women, to non-white voters. I mean, clearly that didn't happen or it wasn't executed. I mean, so what's next for the party now? Do you expect any kind of reflection in 2020?
Look, I mean, first, what's fascinating about this so-called autopsy that you're referring to was it was presented not only as a political necessity that you needed to do this to win in a changing country, but a moral mandate that if you earn the right to govern this big, changing, confusing, loud country, you need to be more like the country. And that just completely was thrown out the window with Donald Trump, and almost with like an audible sigh of relief, like, oh, God, we can just win with, you know, our old coalition of white folks. You know, I think the Republican Party is sort of like the subprime mortgage crisis. It's a lot easier to predict how it ends than how long it takes. And it may take longer than we think. I think it's pretty clear that Trumpism is alive and well and is going to dominate the Republican Party. There is no viable anti-Trump movement in the Republican Party. There's not. There's no market for that. And here's a perfect example. You know, there's kind of another Republican Party out there to a certain degree, and that's these Republican governors in blue states like Vermont,
Massachusetts,
Maryland. So I worked for all those governors, all of them. I love those guys. They are wildly successful public servants. They are wildly popular. None of them can pick their own state party Republican chairman. They're Trump people. Which, if you're into politics, this is equivalent of basically like Bill Belichick couldn't pick who he was going to put in the game without like calling, you know, Mad Dog Sports Radio for permission. It's just inconceivable. Now, eventually, I mean, I think we're in for a period of center-left government. Eventually, a center-right alternative that is grounded in reality, that has some coherent theory of government, will emerge. But I think it's going to take a long time.
Look, I know you've spoken with many of your former colleagues over the years, and privately, you write this in your book, they tell you that they hate Trump, that they just think he's unfit for office, but they've stuck by him because they think that the ends justify the means. What does that mean? Like, what are the ends?
I have no idea. There is no coherent theory of government that is American conservatism now. I mean, if you held a gun to my head and said, tell me what Republican conservatism is today, I'd say, just shoot. I have no idea. Everything that we said that we were for, we're actively against. We're the character doesn't count. We're the anti-free trade party. We're the love on Russia, not be strong on Russia party. We're the anti-personal responsibility party. We're the deficit doesn't matter party. All of these principles, what I thought were principles, just turned out to be marketing slogans. So I've sort of changed on this a little bit, even since I wrote this book, as I've watched them. I think it's less the ends, the means, than just fear. These are frightful people.
Stuart, what are they afraid of?
I think they're afraid of confronting Trump, just in a, this person is going to be mad at me. I think that they're afraid of losing their seats. I think they're afraid of being ostracized. I mean, the Republican Party is basically a club, like the Democratic Party is, and they're afraid that they won't be popular and no one will sit with them at lunch. I think it's really life imitating high school more than anything grander than that. I think Trump, I suppose you have to give him credit for this, sensed that the Republican Party really didn't believe in anything. And if he came in and promised him power, they would go with a guy who was against everything they said they were for. He was right.
Stuart Stevens, former chief strategist for Mitt Romney, Lincoln Project member, anti-Trumper, and the author of the book, It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. Stuart, thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
In her victory speech, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris paid tribute to her mother, Shyamala Gopalan Harris.
When she came here from India at the age of 19, she maybe didn't quite imagine this moment, but she believed so deeply in an America where a moment like this is possible.
Harris is the first Black American VP, her father's from Jamaica, the first female VP, and she's also the first Indian American. Her victory set off a celebration here among Indian Americans. But what happened in India? Let's bring in the BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan on Skype from Delhi. Rajini, how is this history that Kamala Harris made here being felt there?
I mean, as you can imagine, there's been huge interest in the fact that the daughter of an Indian woman is about to make her way to the highest possible office, virtually, as vice president-elect. And she's talked also in the past of the influence that her grandfather played on her as well. Now, Kamala Harris talked about how when she was a child, she used to come and visit India every other year or so. And she would go for long walks as a young girl with her grandfather, who retired to Chennai, and they would discuss democracy and politics. And Kamala Harris, in a number of speeches, has spoken about how those walks with her grandfather had, and I quote, a profound impact on who she is today. And in South India, there's been a huge sense of pride that someone from that part of the world could, now be going to great heights. And people in Kamala Harris's ancestral village were celebrating a lot of interest in the fact that you have an Indian reaching such heights.
Well, certainly interest in the homes of her relatives. She called an uncle around the election who was following it closely. But were others? I mean, yes, in this one area, but were others? Because we know Prime Minister Modi and President Trump have a very good relationship. And yet President Trump tightening immigration laws and especially H-1B visas upset many Indians. So were they following this election because they wanted to see who would be the president-elect?
India, Robin, is one of the countries where President Trump has been hugely, hugely popular. When he came to India earlier this year, he made a state visit back in February. I was traveling on that trip. I was in Gujarat. I was in this stadium where I saw Prime Minister Modi and President Trump side by side in a massive stadium. I've been to Trump rallies. I used to cover America. I was Washington correspondent for many years. There's so many similarities, actually, Robin, between going to a rally in India with Prime Minister Modi and going to a US rally with President Trump. And they actually did have a very, very good personal chemistry.
Well, we've heard of, you know, people worshiping President Trump in that they have like cardboard cutouts of him, life size. Why is that?
Well, I think people in India just revere, there's a lot of reverence for political figures here. But you see that in America too, of course. Donald Trump is popular with supporters of Prime Minister Modi. The two are seen as political strongmen. Donald Trump is a well-known figure around the world. But of course, in India, he has properties here as well. And he's just well-known. But so too, is there a lot of interest now in Kamala Harris and indeed Joe Biden's route? One of his distant relatives has links to Mumbai and to Chennai. And in fact, I think when Joe Biden visited Mumbai, he mentioned how he had heard from a Biden in the city.
Well, but just back to Kamala Harris, you know, in this country, it's expected that the vice president will at some point run for president. They could potentially be also looking at a president of the United States.
Yes, Donald Trump wasn't too popular with a certain group of Indians over the H-1B visas, but there generally was a sense that the relationship between the two countries has been very, very good. Broadly speaking, Robin, I think the direction of travel when it comes to the strategic ties between Washington and Delhi will continue with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. But here's the interesting bit. Kamala Harris and Joe Biden have both been critical of some of Narendra Modi's domestic policies. If you look at the Biden campaign website, it calls for restoration of rights for everyone in Kashmir and also criticizes two laws, the Citizenship Amendment Act and the National Register of Citizens. And that won't be taken lightly by Prime Minister Modi. All that said, as soon as the results were called, Prime Minister Modi sent a tweet congratulating Joe Biden and also another one praising Kamala Harris, praising her success, which he describes as path-breaking and a matter of immense pride for India. It is also worth mentioning, you may remember in her speech at the DNC, she used the word chitti when she talked about her family. That's a Tamil word for aunt. Narendra Modi used that in his tweet as well. Actually, just so that people know, a chitti is the aunt of a younger sister of a parent. Am I making sense, Robin? So
yes,
it's basically, I'm a chitti to my older sister's daughter. And so we'll probably be hearing a lot more about that. I know a lot of Indian Americans felt a huge sense of pride when she used the word chitti at the DNC, because you don't normally hear a phrase like that. And it's a uniquely South Indian phrase as well.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. It is fascinating. And I think we'll be talking to you again, given the interest. The BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan joining us from Delhi on Skype. Rajini, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
I'm a chippy. And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here Now.
What's next for President Trump? We'll look into his past as a media personality and ask NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, will he end up there again? That's next time, Here and Now.